This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. From the surface of the planet Earth, we're into orbit with Roscosmos. Bob Zimmerman is here to note a global record. Bob, what's happened with the new Angara rocket from Roscosmos? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Russia did a launch of its one configuration of its new Angara rocket. This was the second time they launched this particular configuration. This rocket is kind of like the Ariane Group's Ariane 6. It has a modular design, so you can add on, strap on solid rocket boosters from none to four. And this particular launch put up a classified satellite, and it had no side boosters at all, so it was the smallest version of Angara. The Russians, after 20 years, are very slowly putting the Angara into operation now, and they launched. But their launch wasn't really the significant story here, John. The significant story was this was the 134th successful launch in 2022. I'm sorry, it was the 135th launch in 2022, which broke the record of the most successful launches in a year that was set last year at 134. I should note that last year's record was set in the last week of 21, and it broke a record that had been set in 1964 or 66, after one of those 2 years. I don't remember which one, but it was back in the mid-60s. So for almost more than half a century, the world's rocketry and space effort was unable to match the mid-60s in its effort until last year. And lo and behold, this year, it's not only broken the record again, but it did it with 10, 11 weeks left in the year. So we're going to smash that record. And this is almost entirely due to competition and private enterprise, because in the U.S., the government no longer controls the launches. They don't own the rockets. They don't build the rockets, design them. It's all privately owned and built. And so different rocket companies compete for business to launch things for the government and others. And because they compete, they innovate, and therefore they reduce the cost. Of course, SpaceX is in the lead in this, but they're not alone. And the result is you get many more rockets. You get many more customers to launch things because the costs are down. And so suddenly the number of launches goes skyrocketing. And as I point out, I'm behind the black. This cycle feeds on itself. You lower the cost, you get more customers. That encourages more rocket companies, means more competition, and creates innovation. You lower the cost, it means more customers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's what actually drove the computer industry for decades. It's what drives every innovative industry and private enterprise in the world. The difference here is that the full potential of space exploration is literally endless. So this cycle could go on endlessly, and that just means growth for the human race is also endless. And the only thing that could stop it is if we, human civilization, decide to stop it, either intentionally or from willful ignorance or fear, which could happen. But anyway, it's a big deal, John, and it's only going to get better in the next few years, I hope.
A pioneer has left us. Rest in peace, Jim McDivitt of Gemini and Apollo. Bob, who was Jim McDivitt?
He passed away this week at 93. Jim McDivitt was the commander on two different missions, a Gemini 4 and Apollo 9. Gemini 4 was the mission in which Ed White was the first American to do a walk in space, the second man to do, though, after Leonov for the Russians. Then he was the commander on the Apollo 9 mission, which did not go to the moon. It orbited the Earth, but it was the first mission to test the lunar module in orbit, testing rendezvous and docking maneuvers. Because they had to be able to do that to be able to go to the moon. So those were his two missions. He's passed away. To me, McDivitt's most important discovery actually is much less well known, but it was a very significant one. On that Gemini 4 mission, shortly after launch, after they've deployed the capsule and the upper stage is flying about 700 feet away, McDivitt, as the commander, was given the task to try to maneuver the capsule closer to the upper stage, test rendezvous techniques. And he was doing this by eye. And what he discovered was it was completely counterintuitive. When he hit the thrusters to move forward to get closer, he found himself actually moving away from the stage. completely counterintuitive. And what he discovered was that this is not going to be simple to do rendezvous in space. And it really forced NASA and engineers and the astronauts to spend the entire Gemini program practically doing dozens of rendezvous docking tests to finally figure out the mechanics of how to make that happen. It's now very routine, but in those days they had never done it before. And he was the first to discover this was going to be hard. And that was important because it led the way to making it possible. Jim McDivitt, rest in peace. A great, solid man from the 1960s, John.
OneWeb, is this the one that was robbed by the Russians, Bob?
Yes, OneWeb was robbed by the Russians. We actually have, so OneWeb has a constellation orbit. It's been launching satellites. The Russians were going to launch the last 10 launches to finish out the constellation. But with the Ukraine war, the Russians decided they weren't going to launch these anymore in retaliation for the sanctions against them. It not only shut down a launch, but it confiscated 36 OneWeb satellites. So OneWeb had to go and find other launch providers. It had quickly signed the contract with SpaceX, but it also signed the contract with India's government agency, its commercial division, ENSIL, part of ISRO. And they signed that deal, and since one of the major investors is OneWeb is from India, I think they decided to give India the first shot at launching instead of SpaceX, who is a competitor with Starlink. And so this, so OneWeb, that's who OneWeb is. OneWeb has now signed a deal with Panasonic Avionics, which provides Wi-Fi for most airlines. And this is a deal to provide, use the OneWeb satellite constellation to give a Wi-Fi service on planes. This is in direct competition with Starlink once again. They are, both companies have deals to provide airlines with Wi-Fi when you're on a plane. And the competition is great because it just means the costs are going to go down for the customers because they're going to both compete to lower the cost to the airlines.
Hardy Boys in Scotland, let's build a rocket company, Bob. The Space Hub Sutherland. This reminds me of the Hardy Boy books I would read as a child, because they would have a picture of a rocket on the front and I would immediately plow right into it. But this is-
the Hardy Boys never had $45 million in investment capital, though. They did it out of their garage, you know. Orbex is a private rocket company based in Great Britain. They hope to launch their prime rocket from a new spaceport on the island of Sutherland, Scotland, called Space Hub Sutherland. It's under construction, the spaceport, and the rocket's under construction and testing right now. Well, Orbex has raised another $45 million in investment capital on top of the $63 million they had previously raised. Now, they're aiming for their first target launch in 23 out of Sutherland, Scotland. And so this is just another company coming to the forefront that's trying to launch rockets, John, out of its own spaceport. The numbers don't go down, they go up.
Bob, I wonder if the Fish and Wildlife Service know about this. You know, this could be a big threat to the very delicate ecosystem of the outer islands in Scotland.
John, your wondering is accurate in that there was a battle between two different Scottish spaceports, and one of them was trying to bring their environmental movement in to shut one of them down, and that's all been thrown out now. So these both spaceports are going to happen. That's what I see in the future. There's no question of that.
What is Sky Aurora besides a cool name?
It is another rocket startup in the United Kingdom competing with Orbex. Skyrora has actually been specializing in trying to build hypersonic upper stages using the oxygen in the atmosphere for their rockets rather than having to carry it with them. And so they did a test of a suborbital rocket. What is it, about 35 feet high? They launched it out off of Iceland. This was about a week ago. It was earlier this month, October 8th. Well, this was not a success. It was a suborbital rocket test to test various engines and equipment on the rocket for their orbital version later on. But shortly after liftoff, things went out of control and the thing crashed in the ocean nearby. No one was injured. It was an engineering flight, so failure is not a bad thing. It means they figure out what was wrong and they then go on to another test. It's just another company in the United Kingdom trying to become a rocket company.
And they were launching from Iceland. Is this the first time we've heard of a launch from Iceland? I don't remember. I haven't been keeping track.
There's been some companies have been trying to launch from Iceland now for the last few years. There had been some red tape that was slowing those test launches down. That red tape's been cleared. So now Iceland's trying to get in the game as a spaceport too, John.
I remember the early days of SpaceX. They went out to the Marshall Islands, the Kwajalein Atoll, way out in the Pacific. I remember us talking about it, Bob. These little bitty island tests turn into big, great big operations. And that's why I flagged this, because there's a lot of romance to this, and I imagine it attracts investors. So you say the failure the first time is not indicative of the future.
No, not at all. Remember, it's the very first test of a rocket, so things go wrong, and that's okay. You learn what went wrong. It's a test. You're trying to learn how to make it work, and so if something goes wrong, it tells you important information to fix. I should also point out, John, one of the reasons we're getting spaceports almost anywhere is that because rockets are getting simpler and more efficient and more innovative, they can launch from much simpler facilities, which means a lot of these rockets now are literally shipped to the launch site. And that includes the entire launch pad. And they set it up on a concrete pad anywhere, and they can launch. And so you get launch pads in many different places that are very simple and easy to operate.
Elon Musk, the wealthiest man in the solar system, is in big trouble with the U.S. government. What did he do now, Bob?
Yeah, my title of my essay on Behind the Black was "The Government to Musk." Quote: "Nice business you got here. Shame that something should happen to it." This story had an update the next day after I posted this. This has to do with Elon Musk, the Ukraine war, and Starlink. Shortly after the war started, he offered at no cost to the Ukraine the use of Starlink terminals and the Starlink constellation to communicate for their military to communicate with. And so they've been using it, and they've been using it with great success. It's probably been one of the major factors for their ability to push the Russians back significantly in a lot of places. This story begins in early October when Musk put forth his own proposed solution for the Ukraine war. It was kind of a naive suggestion that the Ukraine should cede some territory to Russia and forego joining NATO, and they'd get a peace settlement and everything was settled. And, of course, the Ukrainian officials responded very badly to that, very badly, as did the Biden administration and many on social media. They called Musk a lot of names. He wasn't really making an unreasonable statement, though. You know, he's not a politician, but that's okay. Maybe we should have people who aren't politicians making statements like this. But anyway, so he did that. There was a lot of hostility to what he said. So then on October 14th, Musk said that his company cannot continue indefinitely providing this service to the Starlink service to the Ukraine without some reimbursement. He didn't ask for a back pay for the previously donations, but he said in the future he really would like to get some money. It was costing him $20 million a month, and he's already spent $80 million. And he really thinks that considering the amount of money that has been sent to the Ukraine, maybe some of it should be the Ukraine. Someone should pay. He was asking specifically the Pentagon to pick up his costs. A day later, suddenly, we have a newspaper article describing how the federal government is investigating Musk concerning his effort to buy Twitter. This was really a hit piece in the press, because there was no real story here. This investigation had been revealed in May. Nothing much had happened to it, but suddenly they want to bring it up again. That strikes me that there's forces in the swamp in Washington. Didn't like Musk trying to get extra money. He hasn't paid off the right politicians, and so they're basically threatening him. So the next day, he basically threw in the towel and said, to hell with it, even though Starlink is still losing money and other companies are getting billions of taxpayer money, we will just keep funding Ukraine government for free. So this is the government playing games here. As just the day after that, there's a news article in Politico saying that both the Pentagon and Europe are looking for ways to fund Starlink for the Ukraine. So I guess the pushback on both sides is causing people to take note. I really think there's no reason why SpaceX should have to donate this service to the Ukraine. The Ukraine should pay for it. They're getting like $50 billion from the U.S. They got plenty of money there. They can donate to SpaceX.
Old rule, Bob, never volunteer. New rule is man is the only creature who bites the hand that feeds him. Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black. We're going exploring next, and we have some positive news of probes. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.